Okay. Ooh. Okay. Let's sit upright. Away from the back of the pews if you can, safely. Chest up, relax the shoulders down. Place your palms upward on the thighs as if to receive a gift, the gift of peace. And with eyes closed gently, without strain, lift your gaze, peering through the point between the eyebrows, softly, without strain. Now open the lotus of the heart, that its natural fragrance, the love which is ours from birth, but which often gets crushed like a flower in a storm, let that lotus open and its natural fragrance rise upward towards the light that cometh in the east, the point between the eyebrows, the seat of enlightenment. Connect these two points, the heart and the mind, that we might become whole. Gazing lightly, joyfully, with expectation, through the spiritual eye as it's known, let us be still and know that I am. So simply be quiet for just a few moments. Drink in the space and the peace of this sacred space, of the sacred space of your own aspirations, the indwelling spirit. Let us be still. Shanti, Shanti. Amen. Good morning, everyone. Where I come from, they don't let me sing, and no one can stop me, so I'm going to sing. You have great music here. I always enjoy it very much. But there's a song I would like to sing. Life is a dream, time like a stream, carries our burdens away. Never despair, joy's everywhere, love can befriend you today. Free from all cares, like birds on the air, soar above griefs and worries, seek joy and be gay. Often on earth, things of great worth, worldly ambitions defy. Sometimes a friend helps us ascend up from life's cares to the sky. Love is a star, though shining afar. It can help us and guide us toward light to draw nigh. Love is a star, though shining afar. It can help us and guide us toward light to draw nigh. Haven't each and every one of us had somebody in our life who made the difference? Somebody who encouraged us? I can think of a number of people, but in my conscious awareness, I think being in junior high, which is my reason for not coming back to reincarnate. I don't want to have to go back through junior high again. you may have your own version of that, but that's mine. And so it was a difficult time, as junior high can be. But I grew up as a Catholic boy and was in a Catholic school. And despite all the stories you hear about nuns and stuff, I actually didn't have any of those. Oh yeah, they whacked me on the head, and you know, because I was a nuisance, let's face it. But anyway, I deserved it. But this one nun in seventh grade saw in me what I couldn't see at that time in my life. And it marked a turning point in beginning to grow up. You know, we have high spiritual ideals represented here at Unity and at Ananda, and those of us who are in the, you might call it the Unity movement, the New Thought movement. It's, I don't, nothing new about it, but anyway, that's what they call it. But Paramahansa Yogananda, I'm a disciple of Yogananda and teach at Ananda and that kind of thing. But he said, with strength, he said, your beliefs will not save you. What we believe, we've come through an era of history where spirituality, aka religion, was defined largely by credo, by what we believe. Okay? But now people like you and I and millions all over the world, we're not so much interested in what we believe. We want to know. One thing he said from, Yogananda traveled throughout the United States, came to Seattle, for example, 1924, spoke at the Odd Fellows Hall, I think it was. And he would thunder, the time for knowing God has come. And he had a very strong persona. He was one of the most sought-after speakers in the 20s and 30s throughout America. But you know, it's people that make the difference. My own inclination, maybe like some of you too, I'm inspired by high ideals, but things like great scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita and so forth. I grew up in all of that. I didn't have to go through rejecting it, and I'm very thankful that I didn't have to recover from anything. I just grew out of it. But you know, I've learned the hard way that as much as I find ideas, philosophy, etc., and even the practices of yoga, Kriya Yoga, Hatha Yoga, etc., as powerfully transforming, it's transforming. And what is being transformed? It's the heart. And how does that happen? Is it just through the ideas, just through the practices? To some degree, you have to pay your dues, yes. But I think, when I was a child and I was an altar boy, you know, the routine perhaps, maybe you don't, but I looked up there at the altar and the cross, you know, poor guy was hanging up there, and I said, where are you? Where did you go? That's a long time ago. And then in the Catholic tradition, you have all these saints lining the walls, you know. They're just statues. So I despaired for the fact that where are saintly people? Well, when I grew up later, I began to realize there are saints, and they're around us. And Kevin and I were sort of joking, and Chris a little bit earlier before on the playground at school. I don't know about the girls, but the boys would say, thanks one to know one, right? Remember that? Well, it takes one to know one. And until you strive for sanctity, until you strive for perfection, until you strive to know the one reality that from which we have come, and that is the only reality that exists, we don't know one. We have to take the steps in that direction. But it doesn't, you know, it's like the, I don't know, the President of the United States. you can't just call the dude up, right? You know, you have to get permission or something. You have to pay your dues in order to. And so it is with God. You know, I was reading something the other day. I only partly like science. It's way beyond me, but I like to pretend that I understand what they're talking about. But I read the other day where this body, your body, this building, your SUV out there and so forth, 99.999% space. In the universe, scientists tell us, though they don't have any idea what they're talking about, but they're convinced that only 5% of what exists is visible matter, like this and this. The rest of it, 95%, is dark energy and dark matter, and that's about all they know. It's invisible. That's all they'll tell us. They just know it's there, though. And so even science tells us what metaphysics, the rishis, etc., East and West, have said since time immemorial. You're not what you appear to be. We're much greater than what we seem to be. And yet just that idea doesn't really change us. So as I grew up, I learned about some of the people on this planet, during those years at least, who were still alive, who truly were sanctified. I remember I met Richard Wurmbrandt. He grew up in, I think, Romania, and he was tortured just because he was a minister. The irony of the poor guy is he started off being Jewish, was tortured by the Nazis, then the communists came over, and he had converted to Christianity in the meantime, became a local pastor, and then he got imprisoned by the communists for being a Christian. I mean, talk about karma. But you know, he came out of that prison after, I think he had maybe 10 years of solitary confinement, 14 years total, I think. He came out filled with joy. One story he would tell would be that the prisoners, all, you know, imprisoned for their faith, were all chained, and they would be regularly, daily tortured. But they'd be chained, and they'd be using their chains to beat out rhythms and hymns, such as we sing here, for example. He would go into ecstasy. Now, I'm not sure I would, okay? And you're probably not sure you would either, but it can be done, because that's the reality of who we are. Another man I didn't meet was, there goes that name thing again, Frank Laubach. Anybody ever hear of Frank Laubach here? Oh, what are you doing here, Kevin? Come on. He was a Christian missionary, went to the Philippines. He found that the Muslims there and wherever he was on some island weren't the slightest bit interested in being converted to anything. What were they thinking, right? So he had a lot of time on his hands. And he read in the Bible that we should pray unceasingly. And he said, well, what does that mean? How do you pray unceasingly? And so he had all these years there, and he began a few seconds, a few minutes, and year after year, he practiced what the famous Brother Lawrence in the Middle Ages wrote, the book Practicing the Presence. And he too went into ecstasy, practicing the presence, because space, Yogananda once said in one of his meditations that he would guide people, he said, the body of God is space. And scientists now tell us that it's basically all space. There is more energy in a cubic centimeter of so-called empty space than in all the atoms and molecules of visible matter in the universe. Things are not what they seem. You and I are not what we look like or seem to be. We're trapped in these bodies, but spiritual freedom, soul awakening, is to awaken to a larger reality. And that space we can feel when we sit to be still each day in meditation, in that special spot perhaps in our home, that sacred space, make your heart a hermitage and your robe your love of God, is how Yogananda would put it to those who came to him. Dalai Lama one time in a speech years ago said, what do we need temples for? This is the temple. At the time, we were building our temple in Bothell, right? So I was ticked off. I said, don't say that. We're trying to fundraise for this temple of ours. But I know what he means. In the higher ages, which long ago existed and long from now will return, it's really true. We commune with spirit inwardly. We don't need to go anywhere. But we're not in that age. We need to come together. We need one another. What would it be like if it was just Kevin and I here? Oh, we'd have a good time, no doubt, a cup of coffee maybe, but, you know, would we experience upliftment? Sacredness and reverence in our lives is essential. In our community, we have a residential community nearby in Linwood, about 10 minutes from the Blue Lotus Temple where we do our services and classes, and we have study groups with our core members, and we're reading a book by a woman who came to Ananda Village, the very first of 8 or 9 communities worldwide that now exist, but it was the first back in 1969. And she had met Swami Kriyananda, who is relatively young. He's gone now. He passed away in 2013. And she had the interesting dharma, as we call it, karma, to recognize in Kriyananda that he was her teacher, and that she was going to dedicate her life to serving him. Not personally, although she did that too, but she meant spiritually speaking. And she knew from the very beginning, she was maybe 22, I think. She had been in Stanford. In fact, that's where she first met him. He gave a talk at Stanford University. She dropped out of Stanford because she said they had knowledge, but they didn't have wisdom. And then the moment he walked in the room to give a talk there, she knew. That's a great blessing. And it transformed her life. She just wrote a book after 40-some years about the life of Swami Kriyananda. And we're studying those chapters now. I remember when I left, I sold everything. I was in a profession in my 20s in San Jose, California. I sold everything I had, went off to Europe and India like so many do at a young age. I knew my life was not going to be so-called normal by American standards. I knew as a boy growing up in the faith that something like that, I didn't know what it was. I couldn't really tell you, but this much I knew. When I came back from my journey, I was gone over a year traveling and up and down the length and breadth of India and so on. But I knew, I had this image that there was some person whose life would change mine and who I would serve together with. And that person became my teacher and the founder of Ananda, Swami Kriyananda. Now, we don't hold him in the traditional way as being guru, but that's just a word. He was, throughout my life, a dear friend, gave me opportunities to share the teachings and so forth. I'm deeply, deeply grateful. But it's always a person that changes our lives. It's not a belief, and it's not a teaching. And there are saints, yeah, even here in Everett, they're here. But it takes one to know one. That's the point. You have to make the effort to be still and know, to be open and courageous, to follow the inspiration that comes into your life at any time in your life. It's not about age. Some people in their 20s are already psychological antiques. They know what they like. You know, and they're, you know, I don't want to describe people like that. We have all seen people like that. And yet I admire people who in their 70s or their 80s even go back to school maybe, or any number of things. Because we are space. We are energy. We are not the fixity of form. And even through our consciousness, we can escape the prison. The ribs are like prison bars. This body is a prison. We've died a million times over. What's there to be afraid of? When you've lived a good life, as you live, so shall you die. And the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all these, and the Bhagavad Gita, all talk about the importance of how we pass the final exam. But how we pass the final exam depends on how we studied for the final exam, how we lived our life, who we are. And so, you know the prince and the pauper, the story, right? The prince thinks he's a pauper. That allegory, that metaphor exists east and west because we're the prince, or princess if you like, who thinks we're a pauper. Or think we're body-bound, we're bound by our, you know, our habits and that sort of thing. And we are if we think we are. And we're not if we think we're not. And this is the ancient teaching, but it can't be lived just as a teaching. We have to find one another. Those who, and especially anyone who you feel a certain respect for, you feel is walking the path, living the life, as it were. What my transforming moment was that I had tried all on my own for years. I, you know, learned to meditate from a book, right? I mean, now they have apps. There's 1,000 meditation apps. They're fine, but I've been teaching meditation for nearly 40 years. Student after student after student says, you know what? When I meditate with all of you, I have a good meditation, but when I go home, it's a little harder. And it's true, isn't it? In other words, by our association with the vibration and consciousness of other people, such as we're doing here today, we can be uplifted. I tell our members that, you know, maybe they've come Sunday every Sunday or whatever, and I say, listen, there comes a point in your, we call it discipleship, your commitment to the spiritual path. That's really all that means. There comes a point in your way, in your walking the way, when you shift from simply receiving to when you start to give, to complete the cycle, okay? And therefore, coming on a Sunday, you are giving. You aren't just receiving. Kriyananda taught us in our training as speakers and stuff. He said, he insisted that his speaking was a dialogue. He didn't like the word lecture. I don't like the word lecture because we're in communion. The vibration that we share is a dialogue. And it's not conscious. It's not I'm thinking that, you know, Kevin's thinking that or Jenny over there is thinking that and I better say this to straighten them out. It doesn't work that way. It's a flow of energy, space. And so this communion of hearts, and so that's the real communion, you know, and I grew up, as I said, in the Catholic, and so you'd take that communion wafer. It's fine. I mean, there were people who would go into ecstasy, like Padre Pio. I grew up in Monterey, California, and surrounded by Sicilians, and they were always talking about Padre Pio when I was young. He was a stigmatist, you know, had the wounds of Christ. He would do the Mass, and it'd take him 2 hours to do it. My local priest would do it in a half hour, you know, like that. Because he'd hold up the host and he'd go into ecstasy. Well, is it about the host? Why don't you do it? No. It was an inside job. It was about his consciousness. The host symbolized the communion, means inner communion with the space of spirit. And every tradition, you know, the Hindus do different things. Everybody does something to represent that yajna, that offering of the self to the great self. Okay, parents sacrifice for their children. People go to school and have student loans. you know, all of life is about commitment, putting out energy. Usually that is done for self-gain. But as we become more enlightened, like your fundraiser, although I must say, not having to do the dishes and not having to cook, that's pretty cheesy. I like it. I've done my share of dishes. Nobody lets me cook, but on my tombstone, it'll say he did the dishes. We all do something, in other words. Okay? And America has that wonderful spirit of cooperation and giving. And that's very, very important that we expand our hearts in ways that aren't directly related to what we get in return. But ultimately, all the good deeds, they had in the Middle Ages, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, how many good intentions have you had in the morning to sit and meditate, but, oh, you know, I've got to look at my Facebook or whatever it is, you know. I've certainly run into that, check my emails and stuff like that. And so, you know, virtue, honestly, is a good start. It's better than being a criminal or evil. But it's not communion, because the ego will claim credit for your own virtue. One time, Kriyananda, as a young monk with Yogananda, Yogananda was counseling him to be more devotional, because Kriyananda was kind of an airhead. He didn't use that term. I'm using that term. Then one day, and to get humility, and one day he wakes up proud of his humility. That old skunk, the ego, it's a squirrely dude. And in the presence of someone who has even just a little bit more of that expanded consciousness than yourself, with whom you associate purposely, whom you help serve with purposely in order to receive, because you have to also give to receive. But I remember when I came back from my long trip, the major shift I experienced, having done it trying to do it on my own, but not being successful. I went to every ashram I could find in India. It didn't do me any good. What did Mark Twain say about travel? It's a fool's paradise, because everywhere you go, you're still there. You're still there? You can't get away from yourself. That's all there is the self, you see? And my transformative moment was when I accepted in a wordless way, I can put words on it now, but I couldn't then, when I accepted that I needed to be open to other people and what they had to offer me. And then in that process came this image of serving. I think the words that came to me seem kind of corny now when I think back, but a great man were the words that came. I didn't know what that meant at that time. But it became my friend and my mentor and my teacher, Swami Kriyananda. And that association has changed my life. We each have to walk our path. It's not about, I'm not talking about any person like Swami Kriyananda. I'm talking about the openness to know what to, it takes one to know one. Bless you, and thank you for letting me come.